Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Dave Kusek, who's the founder of the online business course, New Artist Model. But first of all, there's some news from Spotify this week, although it's kind of from the back room of Spotify because it's something that they really didn't want to broadcast. Spotify is making its own records. What it's doing is it's hiring producers, very similar to what Netflix and Amazon is doing, so there's nothing wrong with that. Then what it's doing is it's giving them instruction on exactly what kind of content it wants. So very specific instructions. And this is a work for hire. So in other words, the producer does not own the copyright for the music that they make. Spotify owns everything. Then what Spotify does is it puts out these tracks under a fake name. Now, this isn't on the pop tracks or the rock tracks or the R&B tracks or anything like that. This is on some of the more obscure playlists like Chill and Dinner and Focus. But the thing about these playlists is they do have large followings. So for instance, Chill has over 700,000 people following the playlist. Dinner, and this is just dinner music now, has about 330,000 followers. And Focus, which is primarily piano music, is 2 million followers. So what's happening is that Spotify is controlling these playlists. Now what it can do is it can put its own music on these playlists. And in effect, what it's doing is a lot of indie artists, because it's mostly indie artists in this space, are getting pushed off, which obviously isn't good for them. And the whole thing now with Spotify is the fact that now these fake performers, these Spotify-owned tracks, are actually getting a fair amount of streams, anywhere between 500,000 and a million. So as far as anybody knows, this is an experiment for Spotify. They're not about to take on the pop tracks. They're not about to try to take on Drake or anybody like that. They're just sitting back and they're trying to take control of these playlists even more so than they already do. So look out for that. Again, it's not something that they broadcast. This came from the inside of Spotify, and it's certainly not something that the major labels are very happy about, considering the fact that right now they're in negotiations to renew their agreement with Spotify. So this is something that certainly would play into the negotiations. This will all make for a very interesting end of 2016. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses on bobbyosinskicourses.com. You can also check out my music industry and music production blogs. Just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. Next thing I want to talk about is microphones. And when we think of microphones in the audio business, we always think of, vintage microphones first. We think of Neumanns and AKGs and Sonys and all of those microphones that most of us can't afford or even find for that matter. And then next we think of the clones and we think of brand new microphones after that. But what we don't think of so much are the microphones that are in our mobile devices. And the fact of the matter is that's a huge business. It's a $1 billion business. And there's more and more focus on this than ever before. Well, the reason why is, instead of one microphone on these devices, there are many. And in fact, on an iPhone 6S, for instance, there's four microphones. On Motorola's Droid Turbo, there are five microphones. And on Amazon's Echo, there are seven microphones. The interesting thing is, this market is pretty much dominated by one company, Knowles Electronics. An interesting thing, Knowles has been around for quite a while, since 1946, I think, and they've been supplying microphone capsules to just about everybody for a really long time. If you don't build your own capsules like Neumann or AKG, for instance, and if you're building some of the cheaper microphones, you went to Knowles to get your capsules. A lot of do-it-yourselfers also have gone to Knowles over the years to buy their capsules. But what most people don't know is, in fact, they also specialize in these super miniature microphones that are being used in just about every cell phone. As a matter of fact, they shipped more than 1.4 billion of these tiny microphones last year alone. The interesting thing is, it's just not the microphone itself. In fact, what it is it's a microphone with the processor built in and a whole bunch of software as well to make it work better. But one of the big problems of this is that out of everything in your typical phone, all the technology, it's all been moving forward at a fairly rapid pace, except for one thing, the microphones. And now that industry is turning to Knowles and some other startups and saying, we want things better than we've had before. And what they're looking for is an emphasis on tinier microphones with a higher signal to noise ratio and a higher overload point. Because as we all know, it's pretty easy to overload those microphones, and noise could actually make it very difficult for voice recognition. So the lower the signal to noise ratio is, obviously, the better it's going to be for voice recognition like Siri. The other thing that they're looking for is, since they're using more microphones, and since there's processing on board of each microphone, they're looking for lower and lower power. Obviously, low power means longer battery life, which is really important. So this is a very interesting part of the audio business that not many people really know about or care about or really even see much info about. But it's something worth taking notice, because there's about to be a big upheaval there as more and more mobile manufacturers are demanding more and more from their microphones. My guest today is Dave Kusick, who was very influential in the early days of synthesizer music, helping to develop the Synair electronic drum, and later on, one of the first MIDI sequencers at Passport Systems. He later helped to create Berklee Online, one of the first online education portals. Today, he teaches artists and musicians the world over how to survive in the music business with his new artist model courses. I spoke with Dave from his office in Massachusetts. Let's go back to the beginning, and I know you were at Passport, like way, way back, but let's even talk before then. How did you get into the music business? You were a musician, right?
Yeah, I grew up in a musical family, grandparents, parents. My mom is a music teacher. I played, you know, 6 or 7 instruments, and I knew I wanted to do something in music, and the synthesizer bug got me in the 70s. Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and the British bands started to use synthesizers. And I was lucky enough that I lived, you know, in the mecca of synthesizer manufacturers at that point, which was New England.
Yeah.
We had Moog and Arp and Electronic Music Labs all in New York or Connecticut or Boston. And I went to Electronic Music Labs, which was one of the early synth manufacturers, and I just beat on their door until they had to hire me. And I got hired as a inventory clerk, buying resistors and circuit boards and stuff I knew nothing about, but I was in the door and I was in their studio, and you know, I started to meet the various musicians that flowed through there, you know, Jan Hammer, John McLaughlin, and I got bit by the music bug. And after a year or two there, two other fellows and I decided that we would leave. We tried to make a guitar synthesizer, and this was back in like 76, 77. I'm dating myself, but it was too hard. But we thought, let's go make a drum synthesizer or percussion synthesizer. And so we left EML. We started a company called Star Instruments. We had 3 geodesic domes out in the woods of Connecticut. And we turned one into a office, development office. And we started developing electronic drums. And it took a year or two before the third instrument actually we produced was called the Synair.
Oh, and I remember Synair, it. I remember
yeah,
that.
Remember? Yeah. This electronic drum looked like a flying saucer. We priced it very aggressively. We could retail it for $200. And we seeded Entertainment Tonight. We gave them to Donna Summer. We gave them to a couple of other producers in New York, and we put them in studios in New York, and people started using them. And you'd get the boo, boo, boo. That was the electronic drum. And once we got the product right, you know, it could fit into a drum kit. It sat on a Ludwig stand or a drum workshop stand. People could incorporate it into their kit. It really took off, and we started to just sell boatloads of them. And so I did that for a while. I was 19 or 20. And again, met a lot of musicians, toured the country to all the music stores. And, you know, we did pretty well. And I wanted to go back to college. My parents wanted me to go to college. I was midway through when I kind of quit to go work in music. So I went back to UConn. I finished my degree and moved to California after that. And on the way to California, I stopped at my friend John Borovich's house, and we decided that we were going to start a software company, a music software company. This was 1980. And so Passport, we called it Passport Designs at the time. We changed it to Passport Music Software, but we came up with the idea in Minneapolis. I went to California. We started the company, and you know, eventually we created a product called Sound Chaser, which I got from a Yes song that I loved. The name Passport I got from the band Passport, Klaus Doldinger, the great sax player. And so Sound Chaser was a sound card, a keyboard, and software for the Apple II computer. And it was really one of the very first computer-controlled musical instruments. And, you know, we did sound design, we did recording, sequencing, we did very primitive music notation software. And, you know, things were going okay. It was a bit of a struggle selling a $1,800 musical product in a computer store.
Whoa, yeah.
And it was tough because music stores didn't want them because there was no computer in the music store. So we had a distribution problem. And, you know, I was, you know, running the company and trying to figure it out. And my friend Dave Smith showed me MIDI that he had worked out with the guys from Roland and Korg and Casio. And I went over to his office at Sequential Circuits and I said, holy shit, this is awesome. Can I stick a computer in the middle of, you know, the Prophet 5 and the DX7. And he said, well, that sounds like a good idea. So we did. And we basically turned the Sound Chaser into a MIDI interface. We dropped our hardware and we started writing software. And that was, you know, my involvement with MIDI was really putting the computer in the middle and then helping to take it to market. We had a partnership with Yamaha and Guitar Center, and you know, we started to lay the foundation for the computer music business, recording, sequencing, editing. I mean, it was a big deal at that time when you could change key.
Yeah.
Or you could speed something up, right?
Yeah.
So Passport became a software company, and MIDI propelled us forward as it did many other companies. We did very well, you know. We were able to get distribution in computer stores, music stores. At that point, it was all shrink-wrapped software. There was no internet, no email. And so we would ship pallets of shrink-wrapped software to Software Etc. and, you know, the other software outlets of the day. And we had no idea at that point that, you know, most of the things that we were doing in MIDI would eventually be able to be done directly in audio, in digital audio. And one day, Peter Gotcher from DigiDesign said, hey, come over and look at this. And I went over there and he showed me a hard disk recorder. And I said, holy shit, that's awesome. What are you going to do with that, Peter? Said, oh, I'm gonna make a, you know, multi-track recorder, and we're gonna use the computer and a, you know, a drive from Apple as the storage, and you know, that was the beginning of Pro Tools, and wow, has it really transformed the business?
No kidding. You know,
all those early things that we did really are now pretty commonplace, even on your phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, crazy.
Well, you guys are all in the same area then, right? Basically, Silicon Valley.
Yeah, we were in the Valley. Sequential was there. Digi was there. Opcode was there. Blank Software. So it was between there and Japan, really, Hamamatsu, where Yamaha and Roland and Korg. So it was a lot of trips to Japan in those days. But we had a lot of fun, kind of, you know, really pioneering a lot of the software tools that are very, very commonplace today.
What did you see in the future then? Could you see where we are today?
I can't honestly say yes. We did have a notion of pocket music. Even in the Synera days, Norm Millard, who was one of my partners, always wanted to figure out how to make some sort of synthesizer that could fit in your pocket. But it was just not possible at that point with the electronics that we had. But no, I don't know that I foresaw what was going to happen. The next big breakthrough to me was Napster. And at that point, you know, I had sold Passport. We had moved back to Massachusetts, and I was starting to work with Berklee College of Music and a couple of speaker companies in the Boston area. And, you know, Napster, to me, was the foreshadowing of the future. And that opened my eyes, for sure, and many others, to how the consumption of music was going to change and how this internet thing was going to profoundly impact pretty much everything in 96, 97. That was pretty clear.
Well, okay. So prior to you seeing Napster and prior to that even happening, you were producing DVDs, and that's how we met.
Yeah, I got, you know, I was doing consulting kind of after Passport or the end of Passport, and we were trying to figure out how could we take some of the production software we were creating and move it onto the consumer side. And we got involved in CD Plus, which was a kind of predecessor to DVDs, did a little work with Philips, did some work with Warner New Media, creating some interactive CD-ROMs and music CDs. And then, you know, you and I met. I was looking for somebody to create 5.1 mixes out of a stereo mix, and Mark Waldrep told me, I got to go talk to Bobby, and that's how we met, and by God, you did it.
Yeah, I had an interesting way of doing it that no one else really did at the time, and you don't need to do anymore. So look where all that worked.
That was fun.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Okay, so then next up is Berklee Online, right?
Yeah, in 97, 98, I hooked up with Berklee College of Music through Gary Burton, a great vibes player, and David Mash, a friend of mine. And I got involved with their publishing business, Berklee Press, and we published a bunch of books and stuff with Hal Leonard. And, you know, that was around the time of Napster, and the web was taking hold, and the first dot-com bubble was about to burst. And like everyone else, I was like, oh man, we got to do something online. We got to create an internet musicians portal or whatever. And I was pitching Berklee these ideas, and Lee Burke, who was president of the college, and Gary said, you know, we really like what you're proposing, Dave. Would you be willing to just focus on creating an online school first, as opposed to this, you know, online musicians universe that I had in mind? And I said, yeah, sure. So they hired me, and they said, do a business plan and come back to us. So I did. After a couple months, I came back, and I asked them for $10 million, which I never expected them to agree to. And, you know, after a couple of rounds, they said, okay, we'll do it. Take us online. Build a new business for us. Here's your office. Go ahead and start hiring people. And, you know, I felt very fortunate to be, this was probably 2001 at that point, really given this incredible brand and a clean piece of paper and, you know, outrageous support in music to go ahead and build something. And we started to develop courses. The first course we built was a music theory course. Then we built some Pro Tools courses. And, you know, the Berklee brand was enormous. And it was, you know, it was, I wouldn't say it was easy to build that business, but it was, all the resources were there. The teachers were there. The curriculum was there. The brand was there. The money was there. And we were able to do things that really no one was doing at the time, creating online music courses. And there was a lot of people were very weary of this, both internally and externally at Berklee. They didn't think it was possible to teach what Berklee taught online, that it would diminish the brand, that we couldn't do it very effectively. And so we focused on doing all of those things and being very, very good at the quality of the courses that we created. So we started teaching music theory because that was Berklee's DNA. And it was quite popular and really took off. And we taught Pro Tools because that was the rocket ship that everybody was climbing on at the time. And we started to teach, you know, basic Pro Tools courses. We made a deal with Digi. They helped us promote them. Then we focused on creating performance courses. How could we teach the guitar, the bass, the drums, the keys remotely using the internet? And, you know, there was no YouTube, there was no iPhone, there was no Facebook. It was before all of that. And we had to, you know, put the pieces together to get that to work. And again, we focused on quality. And slowly we built our catalog. And, you know, initially it started where the instructors were, we had to go really woo and charm them to come and work with us in the first year or two of building the curriculum and building the online courses. But after a while, that, you know, there was a line of people lined up outside around the corner wanting to create courses with us because we were very successful. And a lot of the teachers, you know, were able to actually retire from their normal gig at Berklee and, you know, go move anywhere in the world and teach what they were teaching via Berklee Online. And it was a great thing for everybody.
Didn't you have to create a lot of infrastructure, though? I can't imagine the tools are available to do this easily. I mean, yes, you have the guts of the course coming from Berklee because they already had that, the curriculum and everything, but you still have to create the presentation tools for it. So that must have been, you know, a real chore, I could imagine, building that up.
Yeah, well, that is in part what many of those millions were for. You know, I was a software guy, so I wasn't afraid of building software, and that was really part of our strategy, is that, you know, we built a vertically integrated online music school from scratch in code, and we built everything, the learning management delivery system, the sales system, the email program, the landing pages, the accounting package, everything, because it didn't exist. Or at least not in a form that we could find and use. So we built it. And, you know, you and I have joked about this before, now doing what we're doing with, you know, your mixing tricks and my new artist model. Things that I literally spent millions of dollars developing at Berklee, software infrastructure, you can get for $99 a month right now. It's extraordinary.
It's a great time we live in. At least for
it
that.
Is. Yeah. And it's better at the same time, you know, it's better.
Yeah.
So it's great. This is a really good time to be doing what we're doing, but also it's a good time to be a musician in terms of all the software tools and communication technologies that people have available to them.
You know, I want to touch on new artist model, but first, how about the future of music book? I mean, that was groundbreaking as well, that book. I know it sold a lot, and it should have, because it was one of those things that really looked into the future of music. So how did that come about?
So my friend Gerd Leonard, who lives in Switzerland, he's a Berklee alum, and I had asked him to come into Berklee online and help me with a little bit of strategy. And we came up with this idea of sharing content to build traffic. And we created a site called Berklee Shares. It's still probably online, berkleeshares.com. And we began to give away pieces of the curriculum in exchange for traffic. And that site became our number one traffic driver. It was basically content marketing at the time, but we didn't know it was. And so that experiment was very successful, and it got Gerd and I thinking about what is the future of the music industry going to be. And we had been both doing some consulting independently, and a couple of gigs we tried to get together. And, you know, there were a few label offices where we went in and tried to talk to folks about transforming their business, where they literally escorted us out the door. Literally. And so we started to think that maybe we're on to something, because we're getting such a negative reaction. You know, how will sharing change the music business, and how will the internet change it? Napster was definitely the, you know, the pointer, and Kazaa and all the other Shazam, or I can't even remember the names of the sharing sites now, but I mean, it was very clear that people were interested in acquiring digital music. There was no paid facility for doing that, so they were doing it, you know, clandestinely because it was so attractive. And so we thought, wow, people are voting with their feet in huge, huge numbers. This is going to completely gut the recorded music business. What else is going to happen? And we started to think about it, and he flew over a few times, and we would just brainstorm on what we thought the future was going to look like, and what mobile might, what impact mobile might have, and what the business model might look like. And so we did predict Spotify pretty accurately. We predicted the iPhone. We predicted Siri. And it was really from brainstorming, I think, and just not, we didn't have any, Berklee was the publisher, so we didn't have any editorial oversight. We could just do whatever we wanted. And a lot of it turned out to be true. On the Spotify end of things, you know, I really thought streaming was going to become an absolutely huge part of the business, that it would actually grow the recorded music industry. Certainly by now, and it hasn't. And I think the reason it hasn't is it hasn't been as widely as adopted as it needs to be. That it's still, it's not a utility. It's not baked into your cable bill or your phone bill. It's an add-on. And so there's a barrier there. And if it were baked into your utility bill, everybody would use it, and all of a sudden the economics change where, you know, instead of having a few hundred million people using these services, there would be billions of people using these services, and the economics change dramatically for the artists and the content owners when you get to scale like that. It hasn't happened yet. Will it happen? I don't really know. It depends who buys Spotify, maybe. Or what Apple might do. But that was something that we did expect would actually have a positive impact on the music industry. And, you know, well, now it's questionable.
No, it is actually. Just in the last 6 months, all of the evidence is everything is growing in terms of Spotify's numbers, Apple Music's numbers. General revenue is up from streaming, and it looks like this year, you know, it's going to be one of the better years, at least in, compared to the recent past, for the music industry revenue-wise. Everything, you know, is looking pretty good. It looks like streaming is beginning to replace, you know, downloads, which, you know, they're going away quickly. So I think actually, we have turned that corner just recently, but, you know, we have turned it, I think.
Well, I hope so. I hope you're right.
Yeah. Let's talk about new artist models. So then you were at Berklee, you put all this together, and then you decided that you were going to go it alone and put together your own online music business courses. So what was the decision to get there? What was the impetus to do that? And what was the gestation period for the whole thing?
Well, honestly, I took a year off after Berklee. I was pretty burnt out after 14 years. And I thought about it a lot. And I did some different consulting projects in that time, but it always came back to me that, you know, I'm a musician, I've been in the music business my whole life, I've helped enable people to create music primarily in the early days with Synair and Passport, and to a certain degree with Berklee Online. And, you know, I dabbled in a couple of other things, but, you know, every time I'd walk into a recording studio or any sort of a musical venue, you know, my heart would start to beat again. And I would say, this is where I need to be. And I always felt that, you know, what we created at Berklee was wonderful, but it was out of reach of most independent musicians. We sold to a lot of doctors and lawyers and people later in life that had the means to pay for those programs. But the average musician, you know, wasn't going to pay, you know, thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars for online education. They just couldn't afford it, you know, as much as they wanted it. So I thought, well, maybe there's a chance to start over. Number one, as you pointed out earlier, I don't need to spend very much, if any, money on infrastructure because the software services are just incredible. Online marketing had become, you know, much more of a practice that one could learn and employ very, very efficiently. And so I thought, well, if I could create courses that were very inexpensive, very on the ground and practical, very much part of the new music reality, not the past reality, and that would enable people to take their career a little bit further today, in the midst of the chaos, that I could, you know, I could really do something cool and that people would like it. So I started creating new artist model with that in mind. And I started with a business course, my essential program, and I made it self-paced. And I priced it, you know, around between 300 and 500. And, you know, quite a few people went for it. And I got a lot of positive feedback. And so I started to grow the programs out and partner with folks like you in areas where I didn't have expertise or I just didn't have anything to offer. So my goal with New Artist Model is to really create a, you know, 21st century music school for independent musicians, songwriters, producers that are interested in having a career in the reality of the music business today, and also to create a community of like-minded people that are helping one another, you know, both literally and emotionally supporting one another and sharing information. Because I think that the ability to collaborate today is probably the most important thing anybody has going for them. If you're an artist and you want to collaborate with your audience, you can do that. If you want to collaborate with other musicians or music people, you can do that. And so that's a big part of what we do. And you know, we've done a lot of webinars together, and we've created, you know, pockets of community that are helping one another. And that's a big part of it.
How would you describe New Artist Model?
Well, it's an online business school for independent musicians at its core. But I'm also interested in building out other practical courses and collaborating with people that are building practical courses that cover the, you know, the technical aspects of music, the songwriting, the theory, the harmony, the production of music, because I think all of those things, of course, are interrelated. So I started with business because that was where I saw a need and where I had personal expertise. But, you know, honestly, in a month or so, we're going to release a music theory course that's entirely based about on learning music theory by creating cover songs, by dissecting and reconstructing cover songs in a way that we've developed that will actually teach you all about music theory and the language of music.
Hey, music production too. That's the perfect way to learn how to produce. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's so true. Most of the music theory courses, you know, that are out there, or books, and I've looked at many of them, you know, it's very dry and it's hard to understand and it's hard to apply. So we're going to create something completely unique and release it later this fall, all based around cover songs. And cover songs, you know, is sort of a part of a marketing strategy as well, that many of my students and members are having a lot of success doing covers on YouTube and doing covers in their shows as a way of building audience and creating, you know, a connection point for people through the familiarity of a cover song. So we're going to take that one step further, because so many of the people that, you know, I've encountered, they don't understand the language of music. They don't understand the theory behind it. They can play, you know, and they can sing, and they're, you know, primarily self-taught, more than half of the people I meet. So I want to try and help them with the language and the theory of it, so that you've got the business side and you've got the musical side in combination.
You know, it's funny. I was just on a cruise, a few months ago, and there was a band that was on. They were a featured guest artist, and they only gave one show. Maybe two. Maybe it was a matinee too. But it was a modern country band that had a number of minor hits. But they were smart enough to lace their show with a lot of cover songs that everybody knew. So it wasn't 100% their stuff. And, you know, you'd have people bored waiting for those one or two that they might have recognized. It was a show that kept everybody involved. And it really made a difference. And you know, I walked away thinking, boy, that's really smart. That's really wise, because they were getting their point across. As you know, they were doing their own music, and still they were keeping the audience entertained with stuff they knew. And it was brilliant. It was a great strategy. But there's so many artists that wouldn't want to go that way, because it would be against their artistic practice or something. You know, they just wouldn't want to do that. But I thought that was a really great example of the modern way to look at things.
Yeah, you know, especially for, you know, it depends on your audience. If your audience is going to skew a little older, then covers are going to work really, really well.
Yeah.
What I say to the artists that, you know, feel like, you know, they're too much of an original to do a cover, is to do an original version of a cover. Do a cover that, you know, within the first 8 bars, nobody really recognizes it until they hit the hook or they hit the chorus. Do your own version of that cover if you're such a great artist, and draw them in midway through the song. You're going to get the best of both worlds that way, by showcasing your creative ability, but by also, you know, making a connection to somebody that might not listen to you otherwise. I think there's a lot of examples of artists that, you know, have successfully done covers in their own style, and, you know, it's worked pretty well.
You know, I had Jamie Oldacre, the drummer, longtime drummer for Eric Clapton, on the podcast a few months ago. And basically, he came out of a scene in Tulsa. And for a while, all of the musicians in Clapton's band were from Tulsa. And he said, you know, when they first started to play, they were playing all covers, but they couldn't play them like the record. So they just decided they're just going to play them the way they felt. That's what ended up getting them the gig with Clapton.
Wow.
And then all those guys were on I Shot the Sheriff.
Okay.
And he said that basically it was a song that they took and they tried and tried and tried to make it like Marley's reggae, yeah. And they couldn't. And they finally decided, let's just play it the way we play it. And that's what became the hit. And that's what you hear on the record. You know, a great example of what you're talking about, though. Great example. So it just goes to show.
I never heard that story. That's good.
Well, cool. Let me ask you a final question. And this is something I ask everybody. And I'm always surprised because I get such a wide variety of answers. What's the best piece of business advice that either someone gave to you, and we're talking about business advice, music business advice, best piece that either someone imparted to you or maybe you learned by yourself through experience along the way?
There's quite a few. Charlie Kaman was a bit of a mentor to me. And Charlie was the guy behind Kaman Music and the Ovation guitar. Charlie was an aerospace guy. And he created the Ovation roundback guitar with a couple of his engineers, you know, almost as a whim and an experiment. And so I got to know Charlie and Kaman during my days at Star or Synair. And Charlie once told me, if you're going to be successful, and I'm sure you've heard this before, if you're going to be successful, it's going to take twice as long as you think it's going to take. It's going to cost twice as much or more than you think or wish it would take. And it's going to end up being for something other than what you started out for. And I've actually found that to be true most of the time. Certainly it takes more time and money. But to me, the big nugget in there is, you know, it's going to turn out to be different than what you originally started out for. And I think that's, you know, the reality of being in business is reacting to your market and reacting to your customers and bending your ideas to what the market really wants. And, you know, I found that to be true over and over again in my career. And that's my answer.
That's a really good one. And it's one I haven't heard before, but it rings true. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's end on how do people find New Artist Model and anything else that might be of interest to them that you offer?
Sure. Newartistmodel.com is the website. Go and check that out. I also have a free ebook that is at hackmusic.com, hackmusic.com, which is the core elements of the New Artist Model that you can have for free if you just go to that hackmusic.com and download the book. That's how you check us out.
To find out more about Dave and New Artist Model, go to newartistmodel.com. That's all one word, newartistmodel.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or just go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.